Space Cowboy Books presents Simultaneous Times, a science and speculative fiction podcast. Short stories to stir the imagination by contemporary authors.
Stinger by Jean-Paul Garnier, with music by Fog Machine. This is not good, thought Bradley as he turned and saw that the group he was with was nowhere in sight. Ironic to get lost during a desert survival class. He had been hoping to learn the ways of the desert. Now it was looking as though he would really have no choice. Fortunately, his pack had food and water, matches, and an emergency blanket. He could identify Polaris, and so knew he could get his bearings, but he might not be able to get out of here tonight. He walked off in the direction that he believed the party to be in, scrambling over the boulders he thought that he had come over. It was so hard to tell. Almost every direction looked the same, and the sun was up in the center of the sky, high noon betraying his sense of bearings. He hiked for an hour or so before the sun showed him that he had been going in the wrong direction the whole time. He turned around and tried to retrace his steps as best he could, but the landscape all blurred together in one endless cage that was closing in on him. Bradley stopped to sip from his water and scan the area from the top of the hill he was standing on, looking for any signs of shade that might get him out of the brutal heat. There were none anywhere near his vantage point. Were it not for his big floppy hat, the skin on his face would probably have peeled off already. It had to be well over 100 degrees. It looked as though it was miles away, but Bradley spied a small outcrop of pinyon pines at the base of one of the ancient extinct volcanoes. It was surrounded by a series of boulders, which, in combination with the trees, looked as though it might provide him with not only some shade, but also a place to spend the night. His only hope being that it was not in the opposite direction of which he should be going. Opening his day pack, he inventoried his food and water, eating just a little bit in case he needed to make it stretch. The food did not seem like enough to sustain him for the hike across the valley, but it would have to do for now. Bradley set off down the hill and entered the shadeless valley which he had to cross. He hiked for hours, trying to remember to drink water often. The sun was now threatening to go down, and its transition to the west made it, by Bradley's telling, somewhere around 7:30 in the evening. Dark would come upon him soon, and the outcrop of trees still seemed at least an hour or so off. He picked up his pace. It was cooler now and easier to move faster. It also felt as though he was moving for his life. When he finally reached the outcrop, he was both exhausted and disgustingly sweaty. The smell of his own body was beginning to bother him, and he wished he was arriving home to the comfort of his bed and a shower. Alas, he was not. So he went about clearing the ground from rocks and trying to build some kind of softer surface out of the scattered pine needles. When he was finished, he had some semblance of a bed, and laid his pack down for a pillow after removing the emergency blanket. Bradley looked up at the sky for the first time in a while and was amazed at how many stars he could see. It had not occurred to him, but they had been lighting up the desert enough for him to continue his hike to the outcrop. He thanked the stars for allowing him to arrive there safely. Hopefully the sun of the next day would lead him home and out of this fearful desert that had swallowed him. Gathering more pine needles and some sticks, he lit a small fire for the night that was beginning to get scarily cold. He lay down on the bed he had made and listened to the crackle of the fire, while gazing at the constellations that he wished he knew better, that he wished he could navigate by. Finding the Big Dipper, he traced its lines and found Polaris, glad that he knew at least this much. He got up and grabbed two sticks, jamming one into the ground and laying the other across it, pointing in the direction of north. This way he would gain his bearings in the morning. Satisfied that he had done something that could help him the next day, he curled back up under the silvery emergency blanket and fell asleep, exhausted from the day's hiking. Bradley shot up awake and looked into the dark night sky. It was freezing cold, and he had no idea how to tell what time it was. Pondering this, he realized what had woken him up. The air was filled with an almost imperceptible low hum. It felt like it was vibrating in his bones. He looked at his blanket and saw that it glittered with the lighting of nightclubs. Gazing into the desert, he saw that this strange glow was all about. He stood up startled, wondering if the lights had just appeared. From this higher vantage point, he saw that the ground was littered with thousands of scorpions, all glowing in the black light. "Oh my God, have I been sleeping with these all around me? It's a miracle I've not been stung." Abruptly, the thousands of glowing scorpions rose up into the air as if gravity had been released. They hovered upward slowly like a thousand miniature helicopters. They seemed to stand still far above him, then formed a funnel-like shape as they gracefully flew upwards. Only then did Bradley look up and see that the cone of floating scorpions was disappearing into what seemed like a hole in the night. As they disappeared into the hole, he saw a small pink lightning spark through the glow in impossible spirals. Then all went black, and nothing but the night stars and the desert surrounded him. It was next to impossible to sleep after the spectacle, but Bradley still found himself exhausted from the exertions of the day. Eventually, he sank back into sleep with his skin crawling with the fear of scorpions. He woke up with the sun beating on his face, drenched in a hot, feverish sweat. The familiar shape of a park ranger hat then blocked the sun from his eyes.
"It's a good thing you had that emergency blanket with you. Not only did it probably save you from freezing, but the glare also alerted us to your presence. You were lucky that we came across you this soon. You would not want to be out here for long during the heat of midday,"
said the ranger, friendly but stern. Groggily, Bradley answered,
"I sure am glad to see you. I thought for sure I had at least a full day's hiking ahead of me. On top of that, my water rations are running low."
The ranger looked around at the scene and suddenly his mouth fell open.
"What the hell was it that you did out here last night, boy? This park is a preserve. How did you manage to take out that many scorpions?"
The events of the night before came flooding back to Bradley's mind. The last thing that he had seen was the scorpion's ascent. He stood up and looked in the direction that the ranger was staring. There, the ground was littered with thousands of dead scorpions, all with the appearance of having been sucked dry. Bradley fumbled over his words as he explained to the ranger what had transpired the night before. The look on the ranger's face grew grave as Bradley explained himself. The more he spoke, the more he realized how unbelievable he sounded.
"You may be suffering from a bit of sunstroke, son. Here, drink this water and we'll get to hiking. My jeep isn't but 3/4 of a mile off from here. You should be able to make it."
The ranger's finger pointed north in the same direction as Bradley's makeshift compass. Bradley spent the next several days thinking about what had happened and assuring the place that he had taken the class from that there would be no lawsuit. He could still feel that strange low hum that had disconcerted him so during the night of being lost. He bought himself a UV flashlight and began looking for scorpions at night. He could not get the strange yellow glow of the creatures from his mind. He bought several terrariums and began capturing the horrible creatures with a pair of barbecue tongs and a long pair of tweezers. By the end of the week, he had amassed several dozen of them. Still fearful of the creatures, he kept the terrariums outside and put up a makeshift tarp canopy to shield them from the direct sun. Without the tarp, they would die. He was not quite sure what to do about feeding them, but he did not think that he would keep them in captivity for long. Mostly, he just wanted to see how the odd creatures behaved. His obsession continued, and he began to read books about scorpions, all the while collecting more and more of them every night. When Bradley had acquired more than several hundred, by his figuring, he realized that he was begging to be stung. He would have to do something with all of them. Perhaps he could sell them, or perhaps he just needed to let them go, somewhere far off from his property. He decided then that letting them go would be best, and that he should do so first thing in the morning. That night, he would set up a blacklight strip and watch the creatures all night, for they were nocturnal, and he wanted to witness all of their doings. He sat up with a six-pack of beer, watching the scorpions scurry around within their terrariums. They were not as active as he would have imagined. Collecting the scorpions had done nothing to ease his confusion about the night he had been lost in the desert. He still could not believe how many of them he had seen, nor the odd, yellow, glowing cone of the rising scorpions. As he pondered this, his bones lit up with an all-too-familiar buzz. He realized that the illumination of the black light was much stronger than what his small light could produce. He got up and unplugged the lamp. This did nothing to darken the glow. The scorpions still shone yellow and began to hover in their terrariums. Bradley looked up. The air was snapping with the same pink lightning he had seen before. An almost identical window into the sky was opening, gaping larger, wanting for the scorpions whose hovering was blocked by the lids of the tanks. Forgetting his fear, he walked forward until he stood directly beneath the hole in the sky. His whole body seemed to be surrounded with the strange, lively pink electricity. The air smelled sharply of ozone and sulfur. All around him, the terrarium lids began to break with a horrible crunching sound. These floated into the air, followed by the scorpions, again forming a conical shape, this time all around him. The violent hum whirled into a greater frenzy, making it sound like the world was splitting around him. For the first time, he looked straight upwards. There, in the window of the sky, was a great stone. From this stone protruded something like the trunk of a large tree. Instead of branches, vines hung in every haphazard direction. The vines swayed in an odd and seemingly apparent motion. In the center of what seemed like the trunk was a small, depressed, colored circle that somehow looked softer than the rest of it. From this enclave appeared, as if rising from jelly, some semblance of a face. Not the face of a human, but some unearthly, ancient-looking protrusion. Around the tree-like thing hung a silver ring that looked like some sort of miniature conveyor belt. As the scorpions rose near to it, small mechanical arms reached out and attached the creatures to little rivets in the metallic ring. Funnel-shaped devices filled the air around the scorpions, each attaching itself to the tail and poison sac. A horrible slurping sound began, making it obvious that the creatures were being milked. Then a long needle came out from the machine and pierced the forehead of what seemed to be the face of the terrible tree in front of him. He looked back towards the ground because it had begun to feel as if he was hovering as well. The glowing scorpions around him formed a pyramid, of which he was the center. He looked back up towards the tree thing and saw on its face a look of pure and ugly euphoria. The hum produced by the machine pulsed louder than before and was becoming more rhythmic as the thing reveled in some form of pleasure. "It's as if it's on drugs." As he thought this, he felt as though his body were being pierced by 1,000 needles of pain. He looked down again and saw himself covered in the creatures. His body hung feet from the ground. The sounds of the machine made him frantic, coupled with the pain of so many scorpion stings. Bradley continued to float upwards until he was face to face with the tree thing. He cried out, and an almost comical mimicry so did the tree thing. He saw it again make the face of pure euphoric pleasure, and at that moment realized that it was still mimicking his own. The scorpions fell like rain from the cone around him as he felt the small mechanical arms reach out and pull him up towards the conveyor belt. Message Logs from Curio by Robin Rose Graves, with music by Loopool. Message Logs from Curio. This unit was created to survey, determine mining capability of planets. Company property, sent off and left to be forgotten. This unit begins with soil samples. Radiation comes from within the planet, not the star. there is life among the radiation. This unit has identified an aberration in programming, defying mission parameters, to instead study flora and fauna. It thrives. Not despite the radiation, but thanks to it. I have found intelligent life. Forsake my programming, I have decided my own purpose, the conservation of this planet. When you find me, I apologize for the trouble, but I hope you've learned to appreciate this world, like I have. To see this mission through would see this world to its destruction. Tell my creator I've been destroyed. Take my parts and all my data and my memory banks. Know that I spent my time here in peace and treat this planet with kindness. You're Defending Grace by Aiden Kinsella, with music by Red Blue Black Silver, read by Zara Kond, Kim Martin, and Jean-Paul Garnier.
Your Honor, the author claims this to be science fiction. Author, is this true?
Yes.
Your Honor, my client, me, claims otherwise. Allow me to speculate for a moment.
The lawyer attacked the air in front of him with an extended pointed finger.
What is science fiction?
Overruled.
What do you mean, overruled?
She means that this is science fiction, and that in science fiction, only scientific facts are allowed to be part of the fiction. You may not speculate in science fiction. That wouldn't be fair.
Your Honor, the defendant is out of order, and so is the fact that his defendant desk is far cooler and more awesome than my prosecuting desk. Your Honor, Your Grace.
The defendant is the author. He chooses the order.
And I took the time to describe my desk in great detail right about here in the text, so I feel like I earned it.
The author's desk was ornate.
Fine, but I'm on the defensive, though. So I get to be the author now?
The science fiction snob with the permeating fedora crossed his arms with masterful indignance, having spoken up in order to interrupt the author.
Over. Ruled.
What?
Overruled.
Sustained.
This is absurd.
Yes, I promised the peace would be. I want the prosecutor to speak now.
I can't. I'm resting.
Ah, the prosecution rests, and the defendant has won.
The judge removed her barrister's weave carefully, separating its accessory from her full and dark hair. The trial was over.
What is this?
Logic.
This is unfair.
Unfair? Unfathomable. I write you. I decide what's fair and what's fact and what's fiction.
That is speculation.
No, that's speculation, and it's overruled. He's the author.
I'm the author.
He can't speculate.
I'm a poet, an artist, and a genius. I don't speculate. I simply decide.
The author took a sip from a large frozen Coke, apparated at the moment from an Earth McDonald's to prove his point.
What is this?
Logic.
Understandings. Sir, it's science fiction. What are you confused about?
If you're writing me, then why don't you know?
Because I think you're an idiot.
The judge paused for a moment, pondering. She returned her barrister's weave to her hair.
You are.
See, I've written her character as the judge, and also as the judge of that.
Of what?
Of your idiocy, idiot.
See, sir, I'm in charge here. What aren't you understanding?
But the defendant is the accused.
And the correct.
The judge enjoyed confirming things.
I won the case.
There was barely a trial.
That was just the logical progression of events required for the time.
Fortunately, you think I'm a space idiot in space, in the future. I have a laser gun with which to escalate this situation, and possibly with which to blast a hole in the wall on accident.
Yes, but it's one of the big, clunky, old ones from real-life planet Earth, because you're a bad lawyer and you can't afford anything newer or nicer than that.
The author slammed his fist on the table dramatically.
And the author made me poor so I couldn't win this case, even if I had a mountain of evidence in my favor. I couldn't buy a nicer laser gun to help my case even if I wanted me to.
True.
Defending author, you can't even prove you invented science fiction.
The record shows that the prosecution said this while confidently straightening his fedora.
First of all, I want to point out that this courtroom is also a spaceship. Your Honor, may I have a flashback?
Yes, you're defending Grace.
One Gore, hand me the irony. Yes, sir. Thank you.
No problem.
And the spaceships?
Here you are, sir.
One Gore walked across the room into a small door. After walking into the door, they stopped without wincing, took an effortless mechanical step backward, and rubbed at the new and painful bruise on their head.
Ah, hello.
The door retracted inwards, spiraling away from its center to reveal a circular opening. One Gore walked through, and the door spiraled shut behind. Thanks to recent renovation, the enormous industrial spaceship hangar was lit exclusively by lens flares, an upgrade the author had been proud of purchasing. One Gore inventoried the space, making sure that it had spaceships in it before attempting to fly any of the spaceships that might not have been there. One Gore confirmed that there were indeed spaceships, and then they walked down the runway in the center of the hangar to its very back, where the largest spaceships were kept.
Hello?
One Gore bumped into the door of the largest spaceship before it could finish sliding open at their greeting and then completed their walk inside. One Gore traveled to the bridge and took stance inside its console. One Gore began driving the spaceship down the runway back towards the wall between the hangar and the author's office. Next to the small door One Gore had come through was another, much larger door. One Gore drew closer.
Hello?
And then, One Gore's comforting monotone received a singular response. This one response led to a series of responses. Massive, whirring motors. A large, rusty groan. A crack of space growing between the things between the building's two spaces. One Gore smiled. A spaceship crashed into an impossibly huge metal door that hadn't quite finished opening.
As you can see, I went through a lot to get here.
I am also the judge of time on the weekends, which is a great gig because I get all my days off. I must say, to judge the time, that flashback was out of order.
Logical progressions needn't happen in order to fit the definition of science in science fiction, Your Honor.
You should have said that before. That would have helped your logical flow.
No, it wouldn't have.
Your Honor, the defendant speaks fiction.
Science fiction.
Ruled.
The prosecuting lawyer wagged his finger with disapproval.
They never brought you the spaceships.
Fair point.
They just never brought me the spaceships in the flashback, Your Honor. We got the door fixed shortly after One Gore crashed. The lens flares were in One Gore's eyes. I can hardly fault them for that. And the rest of the spaceships were brought to me after we had had them removed from their hangar, dry cleaned and carefully folded up. Besides, I've already won the case.
Ah, but you see, that hasn't happened yet, Your Honor. That win was 15 minutes from now. Allow me to stop that from happening. If we can put the trial back in session.
The win is right now, Your Honor, Prosecutor. The second you prove my logic wrong, it will inherently undo your new case.
Everyone in the room looked at each other for a moment. It's hard to hold eye contact with that many people at once for any more than a moment. They all nodded in silent understanding. The judge removed her weave.
Thank you.
In this episode of Simultaneous Times, you heard Stinger by Jean-Paul Garnier, with music by Fog Machine. Message Logs from Curio by Robin Rose Graves, with music by Loop Pool. And You're Defending Grace by Aiden Kinsella, with music by Red Blue Black Silver. Theme music by Dane Luscombe. Out now, Simultaneous Times, Volume 1, Paperback Science Fiction Anthology. Available at spacecowboybooks.com and lulu.com. Be sure to visit us at our store in Joshua Tree, California, or at spacecowboybooks.com. And connect with us on Instagram or Twitter. We'd love to know what you think of the program.